Hey everybody, and welcome to the Jump Ball Podcast. I'm your host, Mo Dockey, and today my guest is the great Kevin Pelton from ESPN, also known as The Machine. He cranks out team grades, trade grades faster than anybody else I know. We're going to get into really stats and sample size and time of possession versus pace, and then we're going to talk some hoops. So, you ready to tip it off? Kevin, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Oh man, I'm excited. I mean, you are one of my favorite reads. I always learn something when I come away reading your stuff. And then, like I said, I'm very impressed with how quickly you get team grades out.
Well, you know, hopefully the accuracy is not suffering because of the speed. That's the important thing.
No, I mean, they're usually pretty solid. I mean, listen, we all pan these trades as soon as they happen, and then like a year later, we're like, it wasn't as bad as we thought. You know, you never know really in the end, but it is fun when you pump them out. But the most important thing I like to get into, especially at the start of the season, is, you know, the sample size of games. You know, what's kind of a good sample size? Like, when can we start looking at stats and going like, okay, this is kind of giving us a realistic view of what this team's trying to do or accomplish or what's going on this season and all that fun stuff?
So I think part of the difficulty with that question is it really depends on what stat you're talking about, because different statistics, particularly for players — this isn't quite as true for teams, but it is true in one important way — like, they tend to converge on, you know, a reliable figure more quickly than others. So rebounding rates, block rates, assist rates, things like that, where, you know, there's a large sample that you're drawing from, because, you know, every missed shot is an opportunity to show how good you are at rebounding. Every shot attempt is an opportunity to show how good you are at shot blocking. And then those are skills that just are relatively consistent, even over small periods of time. So those, you know, a couple games in, you can start to talk, I think, about what a player's rebound rate is or his block rate is, and it's going to not likely be some giant fluke. But there's other stats, like shooting stats in particular, that are going to take much longer because of the fact that, you know, you only have every time you take a three to demonstrate how good you are at shooting threes. And also, the results of any one given three-point attempt aren't as telling about your actual ability as a three-point shooter as, you know, one rebound opportunity or something like that.
No, I mean, that's really kind of spot on. I mean, we saw it with Clay. Like, Clay struggles at the beginning of the season. It's not that Clay's a bad shooter, he's just in a slump, and we know that he's eventually going to break out of this and get going. But in that sense, so like with that stuff, you don't need a lot of games, but with the team stats, like, how many games do you think you need for like offensive rating, defensive rating? Like, do we get too caught up and too excited in what's going on? I remember last year I got all excited, and we're going to talk a little bit about surprise teams down the road, but I got all excited about Orlando shooting threes really well their first five games.
Yeah, no, I think they've become now one of the quintessential examples of why it's important to look beyond the overall numbers and kind of look at the process early in the season, because Ben Falk last year on Cleaning the Glass, seven games in, wrote using the Magic specifically as an example of, you know, what's sustainable from a team standpoint and what tends to be flukier. And the type of shots you're getting, those tend to be more reliable early in the season. How well you're hitting those shots, that tends to fluctuate a great deal, particularly three-point shooting, where, you know, it takes a large time for the sample to build up. But even when you have a large sample, it's still kind of random, you know, within a single season, particularly opponent three-point shooting, which teams don't, you know, statistically have a lot of control over how well their opponents are going to shoot from three-point range. So that's, I think, the one place in team stats where you got to be really careful with looking at how a team is accomplishing what it's doing. But as far as a general rule of thumb, I would say 10 games in, we know something. Like, if a team is playing much better than expected 10 games in, odds are that's a real thing. By 20 games in, Now it's really unlikely that you're going to have fluke performance. And, you know, as has been written about previously, the standings 20 games in tend to very closely resemble what we see at the end of the season.
Right. And I mean, that's pretty much bad news for the Lakers. They better get their act together in the next 10 games. You know, that's the interesting thing about it too. Like, when I would put together scouting reports, we would constantly just do the stats we would get for teams, or the coaches would request, was you know, 5 games, 10 games, and then the season. And we would just try to see if it's a hot streak and compare and contrast and all that interesting stuff that goes with it. What are you looking at when you're looking at numbers and looking at teams 10, 15, 20 games in? Like, what numbers are you kind of looking at and investing your time in that you're like, hey, this is a predictor of something?
Yeah, I mean, like we just talked about, it's really looking at that shot quality versus shot making. And, you know, the thing I wrote about, it was much earlier than 10 games into the season. But a few weeks ago, I was looking at, you know, the teams that had really good shot quality using the second spectrum metric that we have access to at ESPN, quantified shot quality, and who that differed the most from the results we'd seen so far this season. Now, the team that I came up with was Dallas. And even though their offense has, you know, kind of regressed to the mean in terms of shooting, their league average on offense now, their defense has not come around very much, and they continue to struggle as a result of that. So far that hasn't shown much. But the other team that really stood out by that measure early was Oklahoma City, was getting, you know, similar shots to last season, even with Russell Westbrook missing the first couple of games, and they just weren't making anything. And, you know, well, you know that Oklahoma City is not going to be an elite shooting team because of the personnel. They were definitely going to do better than they had, and lo and behold, now the Thunder seem to have largely righted the ship. So, you know, I think one team that I'm still looking at in that regard is probably the Clippers, who very similar to 2 years ago when they were, you know, one of the exceptions to that 10-game rule. They had that really fast start, 9-1, with one of the best point differentials through 10 games in NBA history. And it turned out that was almost entirely a product of the fact that opponents just could not make any shot, any jump shot against them, whether inside or beyond the three-point line. And it didn't hold, and that team, you know, went on to, I think, be the fifth seed that year, the fourth or the fifth seed. They were playing the Jazz in the first round. And, yeah, so this year's Clippers, I think, also a little suspect in terms of how well they've started.
What, along the same lines, you think it's just guys are missing open shot, their opponents are missing shots, or is it what makes you think this year is a little more is as suspect as that team?
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty similar in terms of the opponent shooting percentages, and, you know, just when you're doing that and you don't have a team that, you know, is expected to be an elite defense, and it's really jumpers. Again, you don't have a ton of control on how well the teams are shooting. The three-point percentage isn't, you know, extremely fluky in terms of opponent three-point shooting. They're a little bit better than league average at 33%, league average being 35 right now, but also twos are way below league average, 48, league average 52. So, you know, I think all of that probably is going to be difficult for the Clippers to maintain.
That makes sense. And the other thing you brought it up earlier was, you know, the opponent's three point percentage. That's kind of one of the more flukiest numbers I felt like all year, or I mean, for the past few years. Like, it's never, besides the Celtics, it's never really the same teams that are in that top five, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, just, it's not, I don't want to say that teams can't impact it, because you can. There is evidence for that. And the best way, if you're going to try to predict how well opponents are going to shoot a team from three-point range, is to look at how well they shoot against teams on two-pointers, which makes sense because that's a bigger sample, something that's more controllable. And then, you know, the better your defense is overall, probably the more difficult shots that opponents are going to get from three-point range. So, you know, all of that kind of checks out. But above and beyond that, there's not a ton that teams can do to control that. And especially, you know, over these small samples, it can make a huge impact, whether, you know, opponents are shooting 42% on threes, as they are against Dallas so far, or, you know, Boston is the early leader at under 30%. I mean, that's an enormous difference in a league where teams are shooting as many threes as they are right now.
That's really kind of the interesting thing, because if teams can crack the nut of how to lower a team's 3-point percentage, that would be the holy grail, I guess. And maybe the Celtics are onto something. Keith Smith wrote something about that. I forget what publication, about how the Celtics are defending the three ball, but that's another conversation for another time. I really want to ask you, because this I just learned about this week, which is interesting for me. But I've always kind of used pace for how fast teams are playing, and, you know, and that works to a degree. But now, obviously, brought to my attention was more time of possession, which was kind of more of like what I thought of as a football stat. Can you kind of break down the pace versus time of possession, one you should use, the other versus the you know when you should use which and all that fun stuff that goes with it?
Yeah, so this is on inpredictable.com, which has possession stats breakdowns, and it will show you on average how many seconds a team's possessions last on offense and defense. So that's useful because of the fact that the traditional kind of measure of pace, possessions per 48 minutes, that's going to be a combination, naturally, of those two things. You can play as fast as you want on offense, and you still only have a certain degree of control, because if your opponents are playing particularly fast or particularly slow, that's going to end up making being a factor in your final pace count. Either way. So, you know, I think one of the interesting examples, there has been a lot of talk the last couple of years. Kevin Arnotts and I discussed it on a podcast last year about the fact that the 7 seconds or less Phoenix Suns, if you go back to that 04-05 first year that Nash's first MVP, like their pace is slower in terms of possessions per 48 minutes than almost anyone in the league is now. But that's largely a product of the fact that at that point there was the Suns were such a huge outlier that no one else in the league was like them, and their defensive possessions were much longer. So they used 13.5 seconds on average on offensive possessions. Their defensive possessions on average lasted almost 16 seconds, the longest in the league, probably in no small part because of the fact that they couldn't play against themselves.
Right.
So if you compare that now, there's no one in the league defensively who takes anywhere close to 16 seconds on average. The highest is the Warriors, and the Pacers are both a hair over 15. No one else is even over 15 on offense, or on defense rather. But, you know, the 13.5 seconds the Warriors are playing, it's become much slower relative to everyone else. It would rank about ninth so far this season, but not nearly as slow as you would think kind of looking at that possessions per 48 minutes. I would say that I don't necessarily find that there is usually a huge discrepancy between those two numbers in the NBA. It's really, I think, much more important at the college level because of the fact that you see A, the longer shot clock, and B, a wider stylistic split among teams that are going to play slow and fast possessions. You know, just with 350 some odd teams, you're going to have this greater diversity than you can against 29 other NBA teams where you're playing a relatively consistent schedule where, you know, all that matters is East versus West. In college, you know, you have some control over your schedule and there's these wide varieties. So I tend to look at it much more there where all, and then the other factor is like zone teams tend to play really slow on defense. Those possessions take much longer for teams to get a good shot. So you're going to think that zone teams kind of play slower than they actually do if you just look at possessions per, in that case, 40 minutes in college rather than pace, rather than the actual time of possession. But it is definitely useful to look at in the NBA as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the really what opened my eyes to the whole thing was the Warriors kind of being, like, I guess, 10th or 11th in pace. And, you know, when you look at the unpredictability.com stats with the time of possession, they're actually third in offensive possession in time at 12.8 seconds. And that's kind of where I was like, oh, okay. But if that anybody kind of helps, hopefully that helps somebody kind of get the understanding of that. I want to move on to our next topic, which is, you know, typically when the season starts, it's usually, you know, the offense has to kind of catch up to the defense. This year, I mean, we've seen an offensive explosion. I mean, some of it's from the freedom of movement calls and all, you know, just kind of everything and everybody playing at a faster pace and trying to play quicker and the three-point shooting. Do you see a scenario where defense is going to have a chance to catch up to the offense? Do you think, you know, what, besides that stuff, like, well, besides the other factors, were there, are there other factors that led to this offense kind of just sort of shooting out of the gate?
Yeah, I think the freedom of movement may be getting a little bit too much credit at this point because, you know, the biggest factor, a single factor, is, you know, probably right now the increase in pace. And it is interesting, both the pace and the efficiency have dropped a little bit from where they were early in the season. That tends to happen with pace. Efficiency, like you said, because of the fact that defenses tend to start ahead of offenses, does tend to get better over the course of the season. And that's where the fact that offensive efficiency is higher now than it was at the end of last season still indicates that this is probably going to be the most efficient season we have on record in the NBA. And given what we know about, you know, seasons before we had full team stats tracked, we can be pretty confident it's the most efficient offenses will ever be in NBA history. But, you know, right now pace is driving it a little bit more. And then it's also come down. I mean, the first few games of the season, when I wrote about it, I think it was 5 days in, teams were averaging over 113 points at that point. It's now down below 111. It's come back a little bit, which is somewhat unusual. You know, usually because of that combination of the game slowing down a little bit, but teams also getting more efficient, the points per game in the first handful of days of the season is pretty predictive of where it's going to be at the end of the season. But it looks like this might be an outlier where, you know, that that fast start did kind of overstate things a little bit.
Yeah, so we sort of jumped the gun a little bit in that regard, and I guess maybe teams realized we can't keep up this pace for a whole 82 game season. This might be a bit too fast for us.
Well, it's gonna be fascinating. I mean, I was watching Sacramento last night against Toronto. They're playing at the league's only the sixth fastest pace, because I think their half court possessions are relatively slow. But, you know, last night in particular, they were running on everything, make or miss, turnover, and their transition from defense to offense was instantaneous. And it really, Toronto like struggled to keep up. And they were also expending a lot of energy defensively. De'Aaron Fox was pressuring up on Kyle Lowry full court, picking up on him full court and going through a ton of screens. I was kind of wondering when that energy would wane, and it never really did, even though Toronto was still able to hang on and win that game.
Yeah, I wonder if it's more just also the younger legs. I wonder if at some point that really plays a role into it or not. I mean, the Sacramento Kings are incredibly young, and when you talk Kyle Lowry and De'Aaron Fox, it really is young versus old. I mean, I used to say that was a game plan against Chris Paul, was pick him up full court and wear him down. But the thing is, your guy gets worn down too, and you're screwed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that's kind of an interesting aspect behind it. Do you think at some point, do you think defense is slowly catching up? I mean, as you said, the numbers have dropped a little bit, or do you think it's more just on the offensive end? Everybody's kind of just slowing down the pace themselves. And like you said, even though they're still more efficient, you know, we're just not flying up and down as we were 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think the shot making has come down a little bit too. I think there's probably been some adjustment defensively for the freedom of movement rules, and you know, eyeballing the free throw rate is down a little bit from where it was early in the season, and that was a factor in scoring being as efficient as it was as well. But it's going to be challenging for opponents. I mean, I think one thing that, you know, I've kind of been thinking about is we've been seeing this reaction to the freedom of movement rules is, you know, they were kind of a response to how good shooting and offense in the league had gotten. The way you were going to be able to stop teams was to, frankly, break the rules by grabbing and holding, which has never been allowed. People will talk about it as rules changes, but it's more just an erosion in the enforcement of the rules. And now that that's being stepped back up, I do think probably we're going to maybe see, you know, the full effect of how good shooting and offense in the league has gotten.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, it really is challenging. Like, when I look at it, and think about it on my end, I'm just like, I have no idea how defenses are really going to catch up. At some point, I think they will in general. I'm just talking the general stuff, not just this season, but the way guys are such good shooters now. And you know, because of Curry, really, to a degree, we're seeing guys shoot from further out even.
Yep.
It just stretches the floor so much. I'm just like, it's impossible to cover the entire court.
Right, it's so much real estate.
Yeah, it's just like, I don't understand. Like, let's be honest, with Curry, as soon as he crosses half court, he basically is a threat. I haven't had a chance to read Tom Haberstroh's article on NBC, but you know, just from the blips of it, I mean, him shooting a three is essentially a layup for him, and that's a problem, and that just makes it incredibly difficult to defend. And you know, you just can't get around quick enough.
Yeah, and I do think one point that needs to be made is, you know, some of the criticism you hear is, oh, it just defense doesn't even matter anymore because often it's gotten so hard to play defense. And just because something gets harder doesn't mean it matters less. I think that's a kind of a strange assumption to make. And I remember hearing this when there was the change of enforcement on hand checking back in 2004-05, and then the next couple of years when the full effect of that started to become apparent. You know, the theory was, oh, you know, you just need to, it's not worthwhile being a defensive-minded team. You should just invest all your resources in offense. I don't think that makes sense, because all that, you know, first off, all that really matters is scoring more points than your opponent, whether you get there with strong offense or with strong defense. Like, I think there's probably some marginal greater value to be better being better offensively. But there's the other thing you see is it's not like all defenses have become the same because of these rules changes. You still see the same kind of degrees spread between the best defenses in the league and the worst defenses. And it's slightly smaller than the spread we see on offense, which is why I think offense is slightly more valuable. But, you know, that's still an important thing. And you see, you know, teams like Boston that, you know, I mean, not that they've gotten off to a great start, but, you know, they're the sixth worst offense in the league, and they're still an above 500 team because of the fact that they are the very best defensive team in the league.
Yeah, and that is absolutely true. I mean, it still holds true. You want to be in the top 10 in efficiency in both, you know, or in offensive rating and defensive rating, because defense still matters. Like, anybody that thinks defense doesn't matter just because it's hard is a person that just doesn't want to play defense at all.
Well, Jabari Parker?
Yeah, no, I mean, between him, Okafor, I mean, those guys are like, no. We're just going to stay on the offensive end. That's kind of the thing. So defense is still an extremely important thing. And like you said, I mean, the Celtics are a great example of it, just in the pure fact of, I really feel like they're winning games because their defense, because they're, I mean, they've struggled offensively. We'll get to them in a little bit, but just the point about them too is, I was doing some research on them a while ago. You know, they're missing a ton of open shots, and I think eventually their offense will pick up, but the defense is kind of the bedrock, and it goes back to that saying, like, offense is going to come and go, but you got to have that defense on a nightly basis, and that's how you're going to win games.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing is, I think it's probably going to be harder for teams to be consistent at both ends of the court with the increase in threes. It really exacerbates the idea of it being a make or miss league.
Yeah, a segment on the jump. Yep. One thing I do want to talk about, I want to talk about my friends at Brand Active Media. I didn't have a clever way to kind of work them into the stats conversation, but. You know, my friends at Brand Active Media, they do a great job with the photo booths. They've had big-time events. They've been at the NFL Draft, Pro Bowl, NBA All-Star Game, LA Galaxy. They've covered big events, but they also do smaller events, corporate events, parties. They're a great, great group to bring in. I always think if you have an AYSO soccer team, you should do team pictures. You should have those guys come in and take care of that. Let them be goofy. Let the kids have fun. They do a whole bunch of fun little stuff. And if you mention Mo from the Jump Ball, they'll let you print all the pictures for free, and they'll give you a great deal. So again, brandactivemedia.com, check them out and mention Mo or the Jump Ball, and they will take care of you. Kevin, let's kind of get to the fun stuff. You know, I talked about how I jumped on the Orlando train. I got all excited about Orlando last year when they started out 5-0. I knew the shooting was going to regress, but I was like, man, this is going to be great. And I was all excited. And then, almost a second after I hit post on my piece and it went up, they just went straight down. and I apologize to any Orlando Magic fans who are listening. Last season was my fault. My bad.
What about the other 8 seasons?
No, I'm only taking credit for last season. I'm not. Okay. The others have nothing to do with me. and it's funny because you look this year and you look at the standings and, you know, Sacramento's looking pretty good. Brooklyn's looking pretty good. I mean, Sacramento won 5 straight games. I mean, when was the last time the Kings had a 5-game winning streak?
It seems like it's been a long time.
Yeah, and you know, if I was good at my job, I would have done the research and given you the number, but I didn't. But just the fact they had a 5-game winning streak, I feel like they've won the season already for them. Like, like, I was shocked. You know, what are your thoughts of these teams that have surprised, you know, pretty much everybody? And Brooklyn's another one. You know, is this just another case of the Orlando Magic, or is there something where they can be sustainable, or is there another team you think that can surprise you?
So I would say I'm less surprised by what we've seen so far from Brooklyn. That's a team that I kind of thought was a sleeper to make a run at the playoffs this season coming into the year. They were reasonably competitive last season and then, you know, went out and improved their roster in the offseason. Ed Davis was, you know, a nice pickup. I thought, you know, just really quietly had a solid offseason. Jerry Dudley has given them excellent minutes, even though that was, you know, really more of a deal to get the second round pick that they got there. So I wouldn't be surprised by that. I mean, you know, I think they've probably played better so far than Detroit has. We'll see if Washington can rebound and get back into the playoff mix. But if not, you know, I think there's a reasonable chance that Brooklyn ends up making the playoffs. Sacramento would obviously be much more surprising given, you know, A, the expectations for this team were so low. We were thinking that they were going to be in the mix for the worst record in the league and, you know, end up sending a really high pick to either Boston or Philadelphia if it's number one overall from is the remnants of that trade they made with the Sixers to clear space many years ago, which then got dealt on in the Markelle Fultz, Jason Tatum trade. So for all those reasons, I think it's, you know, a playoff spot still isn't a realistic possibility for the Kings. They also, you know, if you look by point differential, they dropped down to 11th in the Western Conference as opposed to being 8th in terms of actual record thus far. They're getting blown out by Milwaukee by, I think, 44 last week. Certainly did not help in that regard. And they're another team that I look at, and I'm a little skeptical in terms of their shot quality. If you look at kind of, you know, go based on where their shots are coming from in terms of the zones and the typical value of shots from those zones, Sacramento has the 24th best expected effective field goal percentage in the league. They are actually so far 4th best in effective field goal percentage. And the ratio of those two, their shot making, 2nd best in the league behind only the Warriors. So I think the Warriors are probably a lot more likely to sustain that than Sacramento is.
Right.
You know, I think they'll probably settle down. I do think they're going to be a lot more competitive than we expected. De'Aaron Fox looks to have made an enormous jump from year one to year two, fueled by the fact that he's shooting more effectively. You have to defend him honestly in a way that you didn't have to do as a rookie. Buddy Hield's become a useful rotation player. One thing to their credit, they've done this. They didn't get him back until last night without Bogdan Bogdanovic, who was, you know, probably their best player last season. And Marvin Bagley, I think, looks like a more immediate contributor than I expected. I thought he was, you know, going to put up numbers but really struggle at the defensive end of the court based on what we saw from him at Duke and in the summer league and then even in the preseason. But he's proven a bit quicker study defensively than I expected. So I see them, you know, maybe in the 30 win range, low 30s now, and, you know, not necessarily in the mix for the top spot in the lottery.
Yeah, and I think that's a win for them. I mean, for the Kings. I mean, that's a very successful season in that regard, considering they've been the joke for the past 10, 15 years. I mean, I don't even know how long. I mean, once Sterling sold the Clippers, they became they were really more the joke franchise at that point. You know, so I think that's a huge win. I think it's awesome seeing what's going on in Brooklyn. Just, you know, like you said, it's the Dudley trade again. Just whatever they get from Duds is a bonus. You know, that's something that probably they weren't at all expecting. I think it's fun watching them. I think that staff from the front office with Sean Marks and his crew to Kenny Atkinson, you know, and his staff have all done just a phenomenal job of putting a competitive team. I mean, that was the thing even last year. They played hard. They just weren't talented. They weren't that good.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing nice stuff from Spencer Dinwiddie and Caris LeVert. I'm not sure where I'm at with D'Angelo Russell. I was a big fan of his. I'm not sure if I'm jumping off the wagon yet. I'm debating. I'm on the edge right now there.
I think I might have jumped.
Oh, what was the cause for you to jump? What finally made you just go like, no, I'm out?
Yeah, the shot selection doesn't seem to have gotten a lot better in year four.
Right, which is a big problem because that's the thing. Year three, year four, like this is when you want to start seeing these things improve a bit. Like you don't have to be so massively great, but you want to see improvements. Actually, speaking, I'm going to throw this randomly. I don't know if you're. I'm going to throw a curveball at you. Where are you on the Brandon Ingram bandwagon?
I've never been Ingram's biggest believer. It does seem like, you know, he was the one. Everyone talked about his 3-point percentage when LeBron signed there in terms of his ability to play a spot up role, but, you know, that was a relatively a small number of attempts last season. He wasn't a frequent 3-point shooter, and also kind of out of line with what he did as a rookie. And even though he's shooting 40% from three again this season, he hasn't been very effective in the spot up role. His numbers with LeBron on the court versus on the bench are like staggeringly different. And, you know, well, to use the same term, that Luke Walton can help that a little bit by staggering their minutes and making Ingram maybe more the offensive focal point of that second unit, playing him with Rajon Rondo. You know, it seems like he's probably going to have a tough time reaching his full potential playing in a complementary role alongside LeBron and the point guards and then whoever else they might bring in down the road.
Yeah, I was in on Ingram for a while. I thought it would take a while to develop. I would have, at this point, liked to see a lot more. I would have felt more comfortable in year three, just feeling like, wow, he's really on the right track. It just doesn't seem that way with me. Like, I just, from when I watch him, I just feel he's very inconsistent, very much. John Ireland here in L.A. says, you know, that compares him a lot to Lamar Odom in the sense of, like, some nights you're going to get a huge monster game from him, and then you're not going to see him for two or three games. And I think that's kind of my problem with Ingram, is he just hasn't found a way to be that consistent guy. And so that's another one. I'm close to the edge on the bandwagon. You know, one other team I want to talk about is Memphis has looked pretty good so far. I mean, I guess their biggest issue is health. You know, do you have a feel at all? What are your thoughts on them, if you have any, on the Grizzlies? I personally hate the team and the organization and the city because they've knocked me out of the playoffs more times than I'd like to remember. But they are looking pretty good. And the big question is if they can stay healthy.
Yeah, I think it is, because so much of what they do offensively runs through, you know, Marc Gasol and Mike Conley. And even with those guys playing well to start the season, they're still a below average offense, but they could be fine given the strength of their defense if they're below average offensively. They just have to stay competitive, and it'd be hard, I think, for them to stay competitive if either Conley or Gasol missed an extended period of time. So yeah, I think that's, you know, their upside is not very high in terms of they'd probably still be a bottom rung playoff team at best, but they would be the kind of team that if they snuck in could, would certainly not be the type of team you'd want to see on the other side if you were Golden State or whoever emerges as the other top couple of seeds in the Western Conference.
Yeah, no, that nails it right there. Last team I'll ask you about, and then we'll move on, is the Clippers. You know, you don't buy them in that sense. Do you think it's just to the point you don't think they're a playoff?
Well, I don't buy them as outscoring opponents by, you know, what are they so far this season? Plus 6 points per game.
Right. Do you think they're a playoff team? Do you think, I going into the season, I thought they're going to play hard. They're going to, you know, challenge teams, but they're not going to make the playoffs. You know, and I still stand by that. But where are you on them?
Yeah, I think that was my expectation as well. And, you know, they're another team that obviously health is extraordinarily important for them. They are probably better built to withstand a couple of injuries in terms of their depth. But, you know, so far, so much of their start has been built on Danilo Gallinari playing as well as he has. And I think we know better at this point than to count on him playing 82 games. You really can't count on Patrick Beverley playing 82 games. And as exciting as Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has been as a rookie, still rookie point guards, you know, almost as a rule are not actually that helpful in terms of helping you win. So, you know, if he's out there playing the point for 25, 30 minutes a night, if Beverly is out of the lineup, if it's him and Teodosic as the options there, I think that hurts them substantially. So, yeah, I think they have maybe a little more upside, I would say, than Memphis, but similar downside in terms of needing to stay healthy.
Right. Fair enough. And, you know, the thing I think that helps health the most, and I think is the most important thing, is teams really haven't unlocked this yet, is Gelato. And I honestly believe it. Listen, every time I've played basketball, I've never gotten hurt, and I eat a lot of gelato. I mean, there's a correlation to that. I honestly believe that. And where I get gelato, I get the best gelato in all of the land. Okay, I go to Uli's Gelateria in downtown LA. It's in the Spring Arcade in between 5th and 6th Street. They have a second location over on 3rd Street in Beverly, right by the Grove. This is only available in Los Angeles for now, but eventually they will take over the world. And they will be the king of the gelato, or queen, because Uli's a woman. But Gelateria Uli's, I highly recommend it. They have seasonal flavors. You got to go check out right now. They have in stock is their olive oil flavor. And I never thought you could really make gelato out of olive oil, but they've done it, and it's amazing. You cannot go wrong. Gelateria Uli's, I highly recommend. Definitely check them out.
I'll have to check that out next time I'm in LA.
Oh, well, I know you're a food guy, so I will treat you, Kevin, to gelato next time you're in LA.
All right, I appreciate that.
It's not that far from the Jump and ESPN when you guys film in downtown and Staples Center, so I will treat you to gelato next time you come.
It's a plan.
Done. Great. I do want to talk about the Celtics. They are a bit in the news. They've struggled to start. The offense hasn't looked really good. They've missed a lot of shots. Despite the fact that Marcus Morris is having like a career year for himself, Terry Rozier has not been good. Gordon Hayward looks like a shell of himself, as well he should, considering that was one of the more gruesome injuries we've seen in a while. Kyrie slowly was working into the fold. Once he got the haircut, he looked a lot better. What are you seeing from them? And do you think, like, my feeling is they just have too many guys. They have too many guys that should be playing, and there's only five guys that can play at a time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that hurts them in terms of the locker room chemistry. I'd say I'm a little skeptical that what we're seeing in terms of the results on the court are really a big factor in that. I know, you know, people have kind of attributed Rozier's drop off to that. I mean, he's actually shooting the ball reasonably well from three, which is, I think, the thing you'd expect to suffer the most if you weren't in a rhythm. It's really been his long twos have been way off, and his shot selection has never been very good, which is something that didn't get really talked about much last season because, you know, he was scoring points and Boston's defense was good enough that it kind of covered the fact that they were not a very efficient offensive team in last year's playoff without Kyrie and Gordon Hayward. And then there's something else we haven't talked about. Jason Tatum has regressed, I think, a little bit from where he was last season. People were expecting him to take a big jump based on what they saw in the playoffs. And that, again, the expectations might have gotten a little unrealistic. So I was lower on the Celtics coming into this season, and I think probably partially an effect of that, I haven't been as disappointed by their start as the rest of the world has, because I wasn't expecting this to be like a 65 win team this year.
Yeah, no, I was with you. I've always thought, like, I was concerned about the locker room. This is kind of sort of what we're seeing and what we're worried about a bit now is kind of what I've been worried about all along. I love what you brought up about Tatum because, you know, we always just assume these guys should just automatically make the leap year to year. We think, you know, and mainly fans think development's kind of a linear progression that just goes up, and it's more like the stock market. You're going to have ups and downs. You're probably going to go up a little bit. You're going to drop a little. You're going to go up big and drop. You know, it just takes a while to really get there. And again, a lot of these guys are really young. I mean, Tatum's like 20 now, and he can't even have a drink yet. But he can have gelato. but the aspect of it too is, like, you know, he's doing a lot more off the dribble than he used to do, and maybe that's not part of his game, or maybe that's something he's developing and it's going to take time. I do have questions just in general with that team. Again, the good thing for them is it's not affecting them defensively, and I just feel like they're remove a guy or two out of the rotation, and I feel like there's a better flow. Like you mentioned, you know, kind of just getting into a rhythm is so difficult for players, and it's hard when you know you're only getting 12 minutes a game or 15 minutes or whatever. You know, Jaylen Brown hasn't been that great this season as well, and I think it's just a hard thing when you have this many guys. You know, it's just too damn hard.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that happens is, like, Tatum exceeded expectations so massively last season. Jaylen Brown exceeded expectations so massively last season. And I think a lot of fans, their instinct is to see that happen and think that it means, oh, this player is just this good and they're going to continue to exceed expectations this much. Whereas kind of my instinct when I see that is, well, probably, you know, there was, you know, some good fortune involved in that if you exceed expectations that dramatically. And there's probably then going to be some regression to the mean the next year. Now, you know, maybe not as much as we've seen so far. And I still think, you know, the Celtics are probably going to emerge as, you know, the second or at worst third best team in the Eastern Conference. I think they're going to have a hard time catching up to Toronto because I just had higher expectations and they've started so well and they're just well built for the regular season. All of those factors, I think Toronto is going to, you know, be hard for Boston to catch, but I don't think that, you know, anything below the first seed should be ruled out for them at this point.
Right. Right. What do you think about Milwaukee? They've kind of hit the ground running.
They sure have. Yeah. I mean, they're interesting because, you know, if you look even after their loss in Portland the other night, if you look strictly at this season's results, adjusted for where the games are played and then who you've played, they've been the best team in the league so far because of the fact that they've just destroyed opponents by so much when they've won games, including that 44-point win that I mentioned earlier against the Kings that affected both of those teams' point differential. So that's, you know, an important indicator, certainly.
The other thing that's kind of impressive, and I wrote about it recently, was just you don't expect teams with a new coaching staff to kind of just jump right in and just get going the way they have. I mean, they flipped their entire profile from shooting to worst rebounding team to best rebounding team to I think they're second in three-point attempts now, and some of that's with new additions to the roster and things like that. But they've kind of just flipped it all inside out. And it found success immediately. And that's the thing I find most interesting about them is just, this isn't supposed to, a new coaching staff's not supposed to come in and do this right away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and I think they can keep it up offensively. You know, the talent was obviously there and they're playing just a scheme that better fits the talent. And, you know, the 3-point rate is great. I'm a little more skeptical whether they can keep it up defensively, where their shot defense has been really outstanding so far this season. And you look at the personnel and don't necessarily expect that other than, you know, they've got good defenders on the perimeter and Giannis provides a certain amount of rim protection, but still this is not a team I think you'd look at and think that, you know, is going to continue being the second best defensive team in the league. So I think they're going to come back to earth a little bit there.
Yeah, I think they're going to have to a little bit, but even if they finish in the top five in defensive rating, I mean, that's going to be just huge for them. And I think, you know, should they really be in the conversation with Toronto and Boston? I don't think Philly's in that conversation anymore just with how they started. I think Philly will pick it up, but I don't know if they'll get there. They might just be a piece away. But do you think Milwaukee should be in that conversation with those two teams?
I think they should based on, you know, the way they've started. And there's nothing, even though I'm skeptical of the defense, there's nothing like hugely obviously fluky in what they're doing so far. And then just they've played so well that even when they come back to earth a little bit, I think that definitely puts them in the top two or three in the East.
There we go. That's awesome, dude. Kevin, unless you have anything else to talk about, man, I'm ready to let you go, man. Plug your stuff. Where can people find you? What you got working on next and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, so after the merger this past summer, part of ESPN, my content is usually part of ESPN Plus, the subscription service where you both get what used to be ESPN Insider and the contributions that I and many others had there, and then also all the great video that we have now is through the ESPN Plus over-the-top service. So a great deal for people there, subscribers to that there, and then also on Twitter at Kate Pelton.
Perfect, and I highly recommend subscribing to ESPN Plus. It's a great deal. It's a great package. And you get to read stuff from my friend Kevin here.
Yeah. Yeah. What else do you need?
I mean, that's it. I mean, besides that. And then Kevin, gelato on me next time you're in town. Thank you so much for coming on.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
That's it for our show. Be sure to rate us, like us, leave reviews on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, YouTube, wherever else you go to listen to your podcast. And have yourselves a great week.